Would like to thank Malavika and Alex for the invitation. And as you can see, this is about joint work with first Gustavo Garrigós in one paper, and then Fedya Nazarov in a second paper. The first paper is on the archive, and actually it's going to appear in the journal. And the second one is a version of it, but if you want it, then I have to tell you it's still preliminary, possibly. Okay, so now how does this go? So the object of this talk is convolution operators, which have radial kernels, therefore also radial Fourier multipliers. And Fourier multipliers we will always write as m of the distance function to the origin. And we asked the rather immodest question to characterize boundedness. Now, first a disclaimer. There is, of course, a large literature about specific multipliers, such as the Bochner-Ries multipliers and general classes derived from it. And everybody knows that it's a big problem harmonic analysis to understand them, at least in dimensions greater than or equal to 3. And I should say that I have nothing absolutely new to say about Bochner-Ries multipliers in this talk. So what we are interested in are general characterizations of LP boundedness in terms of checkable conditions on the kernel and the multiplier. Now, as you can see, if I don't have anything to new to say about the Bochner-Ries multipliers, there will be some restrictions in P for which P we can actually do that. So the goal is to, in fact, find a necessary and sufficient condition on the kernel or perhaps the multiplier for which, in terms of the checkable norm, for which the LP boundedness holds. This question can be asked for general convolution kernels and has been asked in the beginning of the subject, but as lots of examples, of course, turned up which are incompatible. This is usually considered to be an impossible question. It may be an impossible question, and even in one dimension. So, and if you think about radial Fourier multipliers in one dimension, or even Fourier multipliers in the Hilbert transform, they're really equivalent with the general problem. So, one has one-dimensional problems seem to be generally hard here, and one should be perhaps, before one asks about general Fourier even radial Fourier multipliers, one should study the corresponding one-dimensional problem. And that's what the first paper with Gustavo is about. Okay, so the more modest question, therefore, is to assume that not only your multiplier is radial, but also your function is radial. And we want to study this convolution inequality for the space of radial functions. Now, the proper formulation as a one-dimensional problem is in terms of spectral multiplier problem. So for general radial multiplier or convolution operators, we really ask of functions of the Laplacian. As we let this act on radial functions, we ask for functions in terms of spectral calculus of the radial part of the Laplacian. So d by dr squared plus dimension minus 1 over r dr, that's our operator. Okay, and for, of course, for d equal to 1, we get the usual multiplier problem. So can we characterize a boundedness? No, if we ask this one-dimensional question, of course, we want to take the right measure on the real line, or the positive real line, which is the measure coming from polar coordinates. So we take the measure r to the d minus 1 dr. Okay, so this is the question. Now, it's probably good to just first think about necessary conditions, and all necessary conditions here will be trivial. Now, think for a moment about the case where the multiplier is actually compactly supported, say, away from the origin. And then, of course, it can be tested on Schwarz functions, which will reduce the kernel. In other words, the Fourier transform is equal to 1 on the support of the multiplier. And if you do this, then the output has to be in LP. So a necessary condition immediately is that the kernel has to be in LP, where under the assumption that the Fourier transform of K is compactly supported. Now, if you drop the support, what you can do is you can take the natural scaling into account, and you can take a Schwarz function, say, well, of course, radial, since we're in this class, with Fourier transform is also compactly supported away from the origin, and you can test the naturally scaled kernels on this radial function, and then uniform in the scaling, you have to have an LP condition on these pieces. All right? So it is perhaps not the usual formulation, but normally what one would like to do, if you look at the multiplier, you take the multiplier and chop it off in dyadic pieces. Then each dyadic piece, you rescale back to scale 1, and then you put a condition on. Now, our condition would be that the Fourier transform of this rescaled multiplier is an LP. That's, of course, it's almost a tautology. It's the same thing. Okay, now there's a remark here at the bottom that this necessary condition in general. So first of all, we assume that P is less than or equal to 2, which is enough by duality. Then for general P, especially P near 2, this necessary condition cannot possibly be sufficient. Well, think about L2. We need that the Fourier multiplier is bounded, not just in L2. All right? So we need a bit something else. On the other hand, it is known that radial Fourier multipliers are necessary, have for specific P, necessarily have some regularity. In fact, in the range where P is less than the usual exponent, which comes up in these problems 2D over D plus 1, then the multiplier has to be bounded and has to have some additional regularity, in fact. All right, so the natural range to consider this problem first, this is still an interesting range, of course, but the natural range for us is the complementary range where P is less than 2D over D plus 1. Okay? Now, here's a theorem. The theorem says essentially that the necessary condition that I just stated in the range for P less than 2D over D plus 1 is, in fact, the sufficient condition. So we have a characterization in that range for, again, Fourier multipliers, operators acting on radial functions. That's still the case for radial functions here. And so just to illustrate this a little bit, there's a number of equivalent conditions here. First one is the one that we want to characterize. The T is bounded on the space of LP subspace of radial functions. The second one, and it's kind of strange perhaps, is that it's actually equivalent to what we call a restricted strong type inequality. So normally these things are not equivalent, but it is. This is not about interpolation. That's for fixed P, right? So it is actually equivalent on the subspace of functions which are generated by superposition of characteristic functions. The third one is the condition that was the necessary condition on the previous page, and one can reformulate it by saying, take a single Schwarz function. A Schwarz function is clearly in LP1, and then take the LP scalings of this and let the operator act on this. So the Schwarz function is supposed to be radial, and in order to be efficient, the Schwarz function, you should think of it as compactly supported away from the origin. Okay, so then you take the LP scalings of these things, you test your operator, and that alone is enough for LP boundedness on the space of radial functions. The fourth condition was the equivalent one that I sketched, and the fifth condition is the one that you use in the proof. Now, see, the fourth condition tells you something about the Fourier transform of the multiplier, but the multiplier is in D dimensions. But the multiplier is of the form M of distance of Xi, M of norm of Xi, so you can take the one-dimensional Fourier transform of M, which is sort of very well known to the people who worked on this, and then you take the one-dimensional condition that the one-dimensional Fourier transform, which is kind of a kernel, but it's not the kernel of the operator, is in some weighted LP space, so it's not longer r to the d minus 1, it's rather r to the d minus 1 times 1 minus p over 2. And since we have this kappa of t as a Fourier transform of something which is supported near 1, there's a bit uncertainty allowed, so it's actually helpful to add the 1. Okay, and the theorem is that if you have this condition, that actually implies LP boundedness. I should say that I don't think there were any characterizations of this form before, but one could come quite close. So, in some paper beginning of this decade with Detlef, we had some epsilon condition, which, more general setting. It's also known that when one can prove a Wolff's inequality for Kohn multipliers, we'll perhaps not go into this today, but then one can almost prove necessary or sufficient conditions, but the almost means that it's up to several epsilons, and which one all has to kill, and that's not necessarily so easy. Okay, so that's the theorem. I should tell you that the theorem is very easy. It should have been proved perhaps 30 years ago, and all it uses is very classical techniques, Hardy operators, singular integral operators, and the realization that there's a competition between a Hardy operator and a singular integral operator, and the singular integral operators cannot be characterized, but the Hardy operator wins. And that can be characterized. That's really all it is. Plus some asymptotic analysis to reduce it to this to this situation. So now today I won't talk about this theorem. It's just sort of a setup. But I would like to there are questions about the functional analytic structure of multiplier spaces that you can ask. And these are usually hard questions, and they become very easy once you actually can characterize condition. All right, so because you have nice conditions to work with. And so I'd like to just mention some corollaries. Now I'm looking at this funny MPD that stands for radial. We have radial multipliers on radial functions in D dimensions. And I should say that the previous theorem, all these characterizations make actually sense for fractional D, not just for integer D, except then we don't say radial Fourier multipliers anymore, but we say functions of the particular differential operators that we could write down, and then they make sense. All right, the first so structural comment about multipliers is the following. Suppose we have a multiplier, and we look at the restriction to dyadic annuli or dyadic intervals, done in a sort of a nice way. And so there was some work on this 10 to 20 years ago somewhere, and earlier than that. Okay. And the question was, if you know something about the multiplier conditions for each dyadic interval, can you somehow put them together? Can you look at the sum of the pieces and say something about it? And so there are examples, counterexamples by Stein and Zygmunt one, and the same one also by Lippmann, McCarthy, and Riviere, telling you, no, this cannot be done. This is there are examples like this. Here you can do it. Because of our characterization, you can put dyadic pieces together. The other comment is about interpolation. I'll say take the multiplier space for multipliers on the real line. Is this multiplier space an interpolation space? In other words, if you have an operator acting on one multiplier space and acting on another multiplier space, does it act on the multiplier space in between? And this is true with respect to some method for our multipliers, provided that this condition that I wrote out about the P and the D is satisfied. Because you can look at the LP condition, the localized LP Fourier LP conditions, and it's not hard to interpolate them. Okay, and it's also known that for the standard multiplier space on the real line, you cannot interpolate. That's a theorem by Zafran. Now, Zafran didn't have the solution of the lambda of P problem, but if you take Bourguin's paper, Bourguin's result as a black box, and combine it with Zafran's method, then actually no multiplier space on the real line can be an interpolation space with any method for two multiplier spaces. Okay, so there's a different structure here. There's also a sharp multiplier theorem using standard conditions like Birzhoff type conditions, but maybe I won't discuss this now. And go to the next slide. So what we really want to do is, of course, coming from there, we want to ask the question, what happens on general functions? Still, we look at radial multipliers acting on general functions. And there was a plan to do this after this. The plan was to look at the equation for the wave, the wave equation, the local smoothing inequalities for the wave equation, to improve them, look at Wolff's theorem to understand this much better in the next 10 years or so, and then well, to do something with it eventually. This plan didn't quite pin out that way, because one day Fedya Nazarov came to my office and said, I'm interested in this problem. And the plan was changed. So I would like to talk about this now, and I start with a result that we finally proved. And the result is that given P between 1 and 2, for sufficiently large dimensions, the same characterization holds true. Okay, so that's the result. Which is saying that given P, then for sufficiently large dimensions, we have an equivalence of LP boundedness on general functions and on radial functions and on just one single Schwarz functions and its scalings. Okay, so that's really the theorem. Now, there's a condition which makes this a bit more specific, namely, it depends on what is the precise range. And it turns out that we do not have a theorem, I would like to say, yet, but there seem to be serious obstacles so far. We do not have a theorem in dimensions 2, 3, and 4, where we would really like to have one, and it starts only in dimension 5. Where we get something, and then there's an exponent, and I come back to this exponent, what it means with respect to other theorems. Now, I mentioned... Well, it better be, yes. Yeah. I said I have nothing new to say about Borkner-Riesz multipliers, which, in fact, this is asymptotically as D goes to infinity. This is smaller than the Thomas Stein index, but not too much smaller. So we'll actually come back to that later, you know, very quickly. So I mentioned there is a connection with the wave equation. So let's talk about the wave equation for rather quickly. And so the connection of multipliers, as I said, and the wave equation was, well, perhaps observed by other people, but, you know, Detlef and I wrote it down at some point. And what at the time, what we were working on was a version of Sorg's problem, not for the LP spaces, but for the category of L2 spaces, where you take the LP norm in the radial variable and the L2 norm in the spherical variable. Okay, and in fact, one can prove almost the best local smoothing theorem in this variable. Now, I should not use the letter P now, but Q. P was before less than or equal to 2, and now for these problems, the Q is actually greater than 2. And now this was all initiated by Sorg's question around in 1990. And the question was the following. You take e to the it squared of the Laplacian, so the natural wave group, and you take the LQ norm, and you integrate the qth power of this AQ norm over a compact interval. So that's a space-time estimate. And now you want to, the question is, what is the right Sobolev norm for the function on the right-hand side? And the optimal index for this, as conjectured by Sorg, is the Sharp-Bochner-Ries index. That's the typical Bochner-Ries index. And it's also alpha of q minus 1 over q, where alpha of q is the Sharp index for the fixed time estimate. So you gain exactly 1 over q estimate. And Sorg asked whether this inequality is true in the optimal range for two q greater than 2d over d minus 1. If you had a positive solution to this problem, you have a positive solution to a tree of problems, Bochner-Ries restriction, Kakeya, Cohn, whatever. Okay, so this is, cannot be expected, at least not presently. And I should say that actually Sorg's problem so far didn't have a solution, but almost it had for some q. And so this, there is a great paper by Wolf in 2000, which is the paper that I'm in awe of, and I will understand for the, still trying to understand what it's all about, and will do so for several more years, presumably. There is a version of Wolf's paper by Isabella Waba and Wolf in Higher Dimensions, which I really recommend to read, because it's a great paper to start getting into the Wolf method. Wolf's paper in two dimensions is far more complicated. And there are some, there's also a version, a general version of this by Manabika and Isabella. Further improvements have been obtained by Gustavo and myself. We try to understand Wolf's paper better and adjust it. And then Wilhelm Schlag also had some contribution. We got together and we're basically in the final stage of writing a paper. And so Wolf's original exponent in two dimensions, 74, was improved to 20. And in higher dimensions, you have some improvements. So basically, the known range is of the form 2 plus 8 over d plus a little bit. And that doesn't, the results for very large d don't actually, aren't actually that difference. Now, all this work relies on a very crucial estimate of Wolf's, which has to do with the cone. You think about a one neighborhood at height lambda, and you try to put the right rectangles into this one neighborhood, and it is about summing the pieces and estimating the pieces in an LQ norm by the LQ of LQ norm of the pieces. Okay, so with the right constant. And this was, when I first saw this, I thought it was a shocking, you know, simple approach, which of course was very hard, but to even write down this inequality, it's a great inequality. Now I would like to state our theorem, which is not about Wolf's inequality, but it's about the local smoothing inequality. And so let Q sub D be the critical, the dual of the critical P, which came up in the previous theorem. Okay, and let's beta be the, now the sharp exponent in this inequality. And the theorem says that in this range for Q greater than Q sub D, the Sorg's conjecture actually holds in the endpoint. And still, this is restricted to dimensions D greater than or equal to 5. Clearly, but it should be pointed out that the exponent here is not longer, well, okay, 2 plus 8 over d plus a little bit, but actually in for very large d, 2 plus 4 over d plus a little bit. Now, I also want to point out that we do not improve Wolf's inequality. Okay, so we do something else. there is no induction on scales and all these heavy methods. Now, this does not make Wolff's inequality obsolete. I mean, it was already known to start with that Wolff inequality could never be used to solve the full problem anyway, because the ranges are different. It was realized in several papers, so this, I mean, I'm just mentioning the advertising paper with Malabika on averages over curves in R3, and then there are papers on the Bergmann projection on certain conic tube domains, where Wolff inequality seems to play a much more essential, Wolff inequality perhaps, or variants of it, seem to play a much more crucial role than for the problem it was originally invented for. Okay, and if it didn't have any applications, it would still be extremely interesting for, you know, just as an inequality. Now, for the rest of the talk, I will go a little bit more into what we're doing, rather than just stating theorems. And I'm not going to explain the whole thing, but first of all, for the multiplier question, let's just assume that our multiplier is supported between 1 and 2. So putting scales together is a different question. For the wave equation, similarly, we're going to look at the case where the function, the Fourier transform of the function, of course, is supported in a large annulus, which means that we're really working with a Beazov-type version of the theorem rather than a Sobolev-type version. But that's sort of a different issue. I'm starting with a wave equation. And since we're doing something for P less than 2, we have to dualize the original problem. I'm writing down the dualized version. Now, the dualized version now acts on functions of x and t. And the operator is some integral over our compact interval. And since we want to make these two problems, the multiplier problem, where the multiplier lives between 1 and 2, and the wave equation, where the multiplier lives somewhere else, we want to look them very similar. We have to rescale one to the other, and that's done here in the second inequality. So there is, and time is called suddenly r, and time is now between 2 to the k and 2 to the k plus 1, but the multiplier now lives between 1 and 2, and we have to somehow multiply this. We have to distribute the right powers that come up in the Sobolev estimate accordingly, so it becomes this second inequality. Now, this, maybe you have to think about what this really means, but I tell you what it means. This multiplier here is modulo a very harmless convolution operator. It's essentially the surface measure, not normalized, just the surface measure of the sphere of radius r, but then, of course, convolved with a function whose Fourier transform is between 1 and 2. So there's a lot of cancellation in there. Think about big sphere, surface measure, and a lot of cancellation. Okay, so that's what we should think about. Now I sort of want to set the problem up in the right way. Now, if everything has a Fourier transform compactly supported, then we know that these operators, the kernels, are essentially, well, not changing over scales of scales 1, right? So we could discretize the problem. It just as in the, say, Poincaré-Polya theorem. And what the function should be is it should be a sum of bumps. Okay, so these bumps have cancellation. And at some point one has to decide whether one likes compact Fourier support or compact support. And it really makes a technical difference here that you have a compact support but lots of cancellation. So this, you should think of this function as having compact support and also compact Fourier support between 1 and 2, but you just have lots of moments condition that vanish. Okay, so now any function which has compact Fourier support can be essentially written as an average of a function like functions like this, so that's enough to consider. And now we don't just do this for the function. We're going back to the multiplier problem, as you see. We do this actually for the kernel. Okay, so we just do the same discretization for the kernel, but the kernel is radial, so we just do it in the radial variable. Okay, so the kernel is now written, the delta function, so which comes up here, is just now this the spherical measure, and we have the convolution of the cutoff function with cancellation with the spherical measure, and our kernel can be written as the sum of discrete radii, say natural numbers R in N, of B of R psi convolved with the surface measure of radius R. And the B of R now also satisfies an LP condition, but because we have this polar coordinate measure, the right LP condition takes this into account. Okay? So that's what we want. Now, the inequality is that I want to convolve these things together and see what I get. So I'm going to, in the next slide, I'm going to write out what the inequality is. So there's a model inequality that we want to prove. This is the equivalent with the multiplier problem, but only local. So this sum of B of R psi convolved with the surface measure of the sphere of radius R, convolved with the function which consists of all these bumps, is dominated by a little LP norm with polar coordinates of the function B and a little LP norm of the coefficients. Now we go to the wave equation. And you will not remember this, but I said that there was some kernel, which was essentially, after rescaling, the surface measure on the sphere of radius R convolved with psi. Now, that function did not act on, that kernel did not act on functions of just y, but actually functions of y and t. Now, t is now called R, and then the R, because of the localization in frequency, was restricted to a dyadic annulus. Okay? So we basically write out a discretization for that too, and this discretization looks exactly as the inequality that we want to prove for the first theorem. It's two theorems. Except that the functions, the tensor product, A of Z times B of R, is not longer a tensor product. It's a general function of Z and R. Okay, and then you prove exactly the same inequality. Now, here you have an advantage. The R is actually restricted to an annulus. Now, why not combine the two in a natural way and just drop this restriction, and then you prove them all at once. Both inequalities you prove at once. Right? So this is the inequality that we want to prove. We have a surface measure on the sphere of radius R, convolved with some function which has a lot of cancellation. And then we have coefficients. We take the sum of R and Z over some coefficients. These coefficients are in some LP space in R, in say ZD plus 1. Okay, but in the last component, we have polar coordinates. So the last component, the R is so the last component, we just have polar coordinates. This is what we would like to prove. Okay, just the sum, so it should be pretty simple inequality. Some coefficients is dominated by a little LP norm. Now, when you see something like this, everybody knows how to prove an estimate of this form. Sum of pieces is dominated by the LP norm of pieces. Of course, you do this by interpolation, right? So you prove this for L1, for which it should be trivial, and then you prove it for L2, for which it would follow by orthogonality, and if it follows by orthogonality, then it also follows in between. Now, if you could do that, then of course you would prove the local smoothing inequality for all p between 1 and 2, and of course it cannot be true for all 1 between 2, so one of these things has to fail, and the one which doesn't fail is the L1 inequality. Now, you can see obviously sigma r has measure r to the d minus 1, that r to the d minus 1 in for p equal to 1 just shows up on the right-hand side. There is nothing going on. It's just convolution with the measure. Now, for p equal to 2, this inequality is not true. Now, it would be true if these pieces, these functions, sigma r convolved with psi translated by z would actually be orthogonal. Right? If they would be orthogonal, it would be true. If they would be almost orthogonal, it would still be true. But they are not almost orthogonal. There's a little bit of orthogonality. Now, there's also one other thing. If you fix the R, then again there's a trivial inequality because, I mean, of course, we can compute the Fourier transform. We know what the Fourier transform of the surface measure does. It's better by R to the D minus 1 half than the actual L1 norm, if you want. And so if you fix R, if you freeze R, then there is an inequality of this form. So it's really the putting the R's together, that's really the issue. Right? Putting the R's together, that's the issue. Now, as I said, we could put them together if we had orthogonality, and so let me tell you what we have. We have to look at the scalar products of these things. So remainder FZR is it's basically you take center Z, you take a sphere of radius R, and you take a band around this, and you convolve a function with cancellation with the surface measure. Right, so that's centered at Z. The sphere that in consideration is centered at Z, and this one is centered at Z prime. Now, if you take the scalar product of these two things, then you get a natural estimate R times R prime to the D minus 1 half. But then what orthogonality for me is there is a little bit more. Namely, if R is away from R prime and Z is away from Z prime, there is some decay here. Now, what would almost orthogonality mean? If this exponent, we are in D plus 1 dimension, if this exponent here was a little bit larger than D plus 1 plus epsilon, then we would have orthogonality. But we just have this. Okay, but we want to see why we have this. So this scalar product, we look at Parseval, we write it out by Parseval. So what we get is the Fourier transform of the surface measure of the sphere, then translated, the translation is an oscillation. We do the same for the second factor, and then we take into account the convolution. I'm afraid that there might be a Fourier transform missing here. So you should think of this function being essentially living between 1 and 2. Okay? And now I'm writing down B sub D is just a radial description of the Fourier transform of the measure of the unit sphere. And so this, of course, blows up by R times R prime, but this has decay and this has decay. But then if you write out these two radial guys, there's another Bessel integral over the sphere. So there's another Bessel function coming in, which is then evaluated at Z prime minus Z. And the radial variable is, as I said, essentially between 1 and 2. Okay, so the road to the D minus 1 here is irrelevant. Okay, so now if you do this, so because you have this Bessel function, then you get immediately this inequality in the case where R minus R prime is not much larger than Z minus Z prime. Now, if R minus R prime is much larger than Z minus Z prime, then this is just, you know, you can draw a picture. You can draw a big sphere of radius Z, and then you have another center Z prime, and you draw a sphere whose radius differs from R, from the other radius, by much more than the distance of the center, and you see that these two spheres have to be disjoint by a lot, which means because of our assumption on the compact support, functions in questions are actually supported on disjoint sets, so the scalar product is zero. So that's what we get. To just think when I started. Okay, not too much more. So now what we want is this inequality, as I said. And let's, for simplicity, which is not quite for simplicity, but it's good to understand the case first where the radii are in a dyadic interval. Now, see this, you see something from the previous theorem that a strong type inequality should be equivalent to a restricted inequality. Now, here it's obvious because it's forced by interpolation. Right? This inequality doesn't have, this is for a range of P. Okay, so we can assume that the coefficients are actually a 0 or 1. Right? So so you get a restricted weak type inequality. We say that they are 1 on a set, which we call E. Okay, so now I said orthogonality fails. But still, it's perhaps good to think about a good situation for which the L2 estimate is actually true. So what would we do if we wanted to prove the L2 inequality? Of course, we have the L2 norm squared. We just expand it into scalar products, and we estimate the size of the scalar products. So I'm putting in the previous estimate. That's what I get. Now I have an inner sum, ZR in the set E, an outer sum, and an inner sum of Z primes. Now what I would like to do to say that the inner sum converges. It doesn't, because the exponent is wrong. But it does in a situation where the set E is actually very sparse that can be measured. Okay, so the sparseness is that if for any rho greater than or equal to 1, every ball of radius rho contains only essentially rho to the d minus 1 half points, a little bit less. So then you can sum this up. So then you have a good estimate. And the other estimate, I just remind you, was for fixed R. That was because of the size of the Fourier transform. Okay, so now there's a Cardan-Sigmund argument, and this is really something which I couldn't have thought of myself for sure. Although it turns out to be, you know, not really technical. So the idea is we would like to study situations where the L2 estimate fails to some degree. And here's the situation. Now we say that given a large number u, essentially think of it as a power of 2, and I'm going to ignore this r, and I'm going to count how many members of the set E are in a ball of radius rho, and the good situation was rho to the d minus 1 half minus a little bit, right? But now I'm trying to violate this. I'm putting in this factor u. If this is large, then I'm larger than I'm taking u. Okay, and so you expect that the bound, the good bound that I just gave you, will actually blow up in terms of u. And so we take this situation and we formulate a lemma. What we do in this lemma is to just compute scalar products. And in the situations where I can't do scalar products, I use Cauchy-Schwarz. And one tries to really optimize it, and it's a bit of a lengthy procedure to optimize this. But the outcome of this would be, in this situation, the L2 estimate, using both observations before, will blow up by a rather moderate power of u. Because remember, it's really the orthogonality with respect to the R variables that fails. So that's a rather moderate power of u. Okay, so now in this situation, you actually want to say something about the LP estimate. Somehow, if the L1 estimate could get much better at the same time, then you can interpolate and you gain something. All right? And so that is indeed what happens. Now, see, what happens here, if you have a U, which is really large, then a ball, some fairly small ball, may contain a lot of points. Okay, so if you measure support of our functions, what can we say about the support? If we just have one point, the support is a big sphere, an annulus around a big sphere, right? Now we have many points, we could just sum up the supports. But if these guys are really crowded here, maybe it's much more efficient to do this, to gather them in one single ball, and then say the support of this is actually a slightly larger neighborhood of one sphere. Okay, and so this is actually what goes on. That's a very simple idea. That and what you do now, this is written here. So for large u, the two bounds become worse. There would be a crowding effect. If there's a crowding effect, it will result in smaller support of the functions, which will therefore result in a better L1 estimate. And so here's a lemma which you can think of as a variant of a Cardan-Sigmund type decomposition. You can decompose the set E into sets E of 1, E of 2, E of 4, and so on, so that each set can be covered by 1 over U, this is great, times the cardinality of E balls. I mean, think of each ball containing about U points, so you're getting 1 over U there, right? of radius u to the 1 over h, or the minimum of r and u to the 1 over h. And then E of u has this property that was good for the L2 estimate, okay, with the parameter u. All right, and then there's a support size. There's a support. So this parameter of u that we want to choose these balls as u to the reciprocal of d minus 1 over 2 or close by. That's what the 1 over h is. Then the support size is actually not just the cardinality of E times R to the D minus 1, which is the trivial estimate, but we gain a little bit. We gain 1 over U, we also lose, because these balls are, of course, not of radius 1, but slightly larger. So, but that's the support size. Now, if you put this together, and it seems pretty simple, then you estimate the LP norm by the support in terms of an L2 norm, and you gain something, perhaps. You figure out what you gain, when you gain, and there's an inequality. And this inequality leads to our condition. If this exponent there of u is negative, you can sum over dyadic u, and we're done. Okay, so pretty simple. I guess I'm just done, so maybe I'll stop here.